Here in the United States, we kind of tend to keep things a little simple, okay? For instance, the title for president is simply President of the United States. That's it, right? Of course, it didn't always start out that way, especially if you're a history buff. You know that some people at the beginning of the country thought the president should be addressed as Your Majesty, Protector of the United States' Liberties, okay? Which sounds like a mouthful, okay? Others agitated for His Electoral Highness. Nothing pretentious about that. Because it all came down to this idea that an impressive title was important to confer and communicate the dignity of the office, right? Fortunately, Thomas Jefferson weighed in by calling the whole idea, in his words, the most superlatively ridiculous thing I ever heard of. And Ben Franklin said it was all absolutely mad. And so President of the United States eventually stuck. Not so much in Great Britain, though. You know what Queen Elizabeth's official title is? I looked it up. This is it. Elizabeth II, by the grace of God, of the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland, and of her realms and territories, Queen, Head of the Commonwealth, Defender of the Faith. Okay. Wow. I guess that's why Your Majesty is kind of what she basically goes by. It all seems kind of silly, especially to us Americans, doesn't it? Except for the fact that titles do tend to kind of convey a certain gravitas. They're meant to describe the person who holds them, to maybe give a bit of a summary of who they are or why they're significant. I had a colleague in my very first call who always insisted he be called Reverend Doctor, okay? Which made me laugh. He seemed to think that if he used that title at restaurants, he'd get better reservations for dinner. Okay? So I went home. I told Barbie, you know what? I think it's a good idea if she referred to me from now on as the Right Venerable Most Holy Reverend Campo. Okay? She asked if I wanted her to do that in public or if I thought she was going to do it in private too. And I said, well, you know, in private would be okay. And she fell down laughing. And when she picked herself up, she simply said, I was lucky that she didn't use the titles that I truly deserved. The truth is I'm uncomfortable sometimes sharing this title of pastor that I carry with me to strangers, like on planes and places like that, because I find that people make assumptions about who I am based on that title. So sometimes I consider telling people, you know, that I'm an exotic dancer. Because that's believable, right? Because as soon as I say that my title is pastor, suddenly the whole conversation changes. It happens every time. They start apologizing for the language they were just using. Okay? They start acting like they're suddenly gone to confession or something. And how they're not really religious, but they're really very spiritual. And then they start calling me Father. Mm-hmm. I mean, they know the title, but they don't know me. Even if suddenly they think they do based on the title. They don't know what makes me laugh or what makes me cry, what motivates me or what I'm afraid of. See, a title is not a knife. A title helps, but the real question is, who is it behind that title? Now, in the Bible, God is called by many names, many titles. Each of those reveals a bit of who He is. Okay? And we're spending the four Sundays of Advent this year looking at four titles for Jesus found in Isaiah's prophecy in chapter 9. Now, you've probably heard them before in Handel's Messiah, if you like that kind of music, during this time of the year. This is what Isaiah says. He says, 700 years before Jesus, he says this. For to us a child is born, to us a son is given, and he will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Now, what's going on in the surrounding chapters is that Isaiah is looking forward to this time of unparalleled prosperity and peace for the nation, because they've been having a hard go of it. And he's looking forward to when there's going to be a new king and everything is going to be great. But we on this side of Isaiah, we know that no such time ever actually appeared. That's why in the later books of the Old Testament, we find that they're still holding on to this hope for a future ruler, still holding on to this promise of a future period of blessing and prosperity. But by the end of the Old Testament, that ruler still has not arrived. And the fulfillment of those promises, we're going to have to wait until sometime beyond the Old Testament. But early Christians read those prophecies, including this one from Isaiah, and they said, Hey, that's Jesus. He's talking about Jesus. I mean, they heard the unmistakable melody of Jesus echoing in these titles. They saw the recognizable form of the Savior in what Isaiah foretold. They looked at the life and death and resurrection of Jesus and saw in him the fulfillment of what the Old Testament promised that God would do. Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. So the question is, who is it behind those titles? And this morning, the second Sunday of Advent, we're going to talk a little bit about Mighty God and what that means. Now, when the four Gospels introduce us to Jesus, each one takes a different approach in helping us to get to know who he is. I mean, Luke is the most familiar one for us because he fills his introduction to Jesus with angels and stars and shepherds and a dirty stable and a holy infant. We love that story. Matthew, on the other hand, maybe not quite as familiar. He emphasizes Joseph's dreams and how sometime later there was a visit by three mysterious kings giving rise to Herod's fear and a hasty retreat to Egypt. Well, the passage that we just heard read from John is his take on Christmas too, but he doesn't include any heartwarming story at all. John uses poetry instead. Beginning with creation and ending with the eternal God taking on flesh and coming to dwell among humanity. In John's nativity scene, there is only this deep silence before anything was created. And John says, even then, the Word already was. And this Word was with God. And this Word was God. That's where John begins, because he wants to emphasize the deity of Jesus. He wants to make it clear that Jesus is the Lord of Lords and the King of Kings and Mighty God in the flesh. Now, John uses this term, the Word, and he packs a lot of meaning into that phrase. Among other things, it conveys the sense of the structure that underlies the whole universe. The Word is what holds everything together. The Word is what makes things work. The Word is the glue that somehow unites all aspects of our wonderfully complex cosmos. That's part of what John means in today's gospel when he uses that term, Word. And this Word is not made at some moment in time. It always was, and it always is, and it always will be. The Word is with God, and the Word is God. The Word is the creator of the universe. In this Word are both light and life. So ultimately, who John is talking about is Jesus. Because Jesus is the expression of God in the flesh. Jesus is not just the representation of God, like a hologram is a representation of a person, but he is the manifestation of God with skin on. And that's what brings us back to Isaiah's prophecy. This baby in a manger isn't just a baby, cute and sweet and cuddly, and isn't that nice? This baby is Mighty God. Now, that term Mighty God occurs 42 times in the Old Testament. And it always describes majesty and strength and the greatness of God as a mighty one, a mighty warrior, a mighty hunter. He is the Mighty God. He is the strongest of the strong. He is the greatest of the great. He is the mightiest of the mighty. Daniel 2 says, wisdom and power are his. He's the one who has measured the waters of the earth in the hollow of his hands. Try this sometime. Just try holding some water, any amount of water, in the palm of your hand. 2/3 of the earth is water, and in some places that water runs over 6 miles deep. And if you take all that water and you pour it into God's hands, He can hold it, says Isaiah chapter 40. The closest star to us, other than the sun, is about 26 trillion miles away, and God says, yeah, let me measure that. And the Bible says he uses the width of his hand. When I was little, my dad would occasionally bring me to work with him. He worked at the railroad, and at the time he worked out in the yard keeping track of railroad cars, where they went, where they came from, what company had loaned them out, which railroad owed money for their use. And as we wandered through the yard together, tagging boxcars and checking tracks, I was in awe. The place was huge, and it seemed to me that my dad ran it. Okay? And I belonged there because I was his son. I felt small, and he felt big. And that felt just right, just the way it should be. I didn't need to be big because he was big, and that was enough. And that's who Jesus is. Don't miss that this Christmas. Don't miss that this sweet little baby boy whom we're waiting to celebrate is also mighty God, and there was no one like him. I am small, and he is big, and that's the way it's supposed to be, and that's just right. And yet, here is the mystery and the majesty and the miracle of it all. John tells us this mighty God came in the flesh to live among us. Now remember what we just said a moment ago about how John uses that phrase, the Word, that it's the structure that underlies everything. The Word who creates and sustains the entire marvelous universe from unimaginable galaxies down to unimaginable subatomic particles. This Word becomes flesh, becomes a baby who wets and cries and shivers in the cold. The mighty God comes wrapped in rags. He goes from the highest to the lowest. And that's what is so incredible. The mighty God is willing to make himself nothing, to take on our humanity in all its finitude and frailty, and not just to put on a body, but to put on our very human nature with all our suffering and all our decay, so that he can live among us, so that he can save us, so that he can draw us near to him. The only time in all of his ministry that Jesus is ever going to look down on us is when he hangs from a cross. So how do we respond in this season to this mighty God? It seems to me when we see the greatness and majesty of God, the appropriate response is heartfelt worship. I'm looking forward to our Christmas services again this year. I do every year. I just love it. I love the early family services with the worship band's inspiring music and the way we tell the story with a cast of kids who are just awesome. And I can't wait for the later services and the instrumentalists and the choir and the strings and the woodwinds and the soft glow as we all light candles in the darkened sanctuary and sing Silent Night as those candles twinkle amid the shadows like tiny little stars. It simply moves my soul. It does. It is stunning and inspiring, and I can't help but feel drawn closer to God in that setting. Then again, I was at Black Mesa a few weeks ago with Candace and Steve, and we were delivering coats to Pastor J.R. to give away to the community on the reservation there. And it was Sunday morning, and we worshiped there, which was another kind of experience altogether. The service was supposed to start at 10 a.m. But at 10:15, it was the three of us, Pastor J.R., a bass player, and two women. But that didn't really seem to bother anyone. Because little by little by little, over the next 45 minutes, people kind of filtered in, and then they'd wander back out, then they'd wander back in again until by the time JR started his sermon, something like a congregation had finally gathered. The president of the congregation sat in a chair behind the pulpit, and at one point, he got up and wandered out too. Returned a little while later with coffee in his hand. Sat down again. I thought to myself, hey, they have their own Pastor Mike. You like that one, don't you? The two women went up to the front to lead the singing. Neither of them could carry a tune, okay? Though one of them said that her great desire is to sing in a full-on choir someday. And every time they started a new song, each woman would begin on a note of her own choosing, completely unrelated to the note her partner started with. And a couple minutes later, the guy on the bass, he'd join in too, though I'm pretty sure he wasn't playing the same song. Pastor J.R. strummed along on his guitar in whatever key he seemed to fancy. And the bass player never really seemed to know when the song ended because he'd just keep on playing. Even when J.R. got up and started speaking, he was just in the background still playing along. From the perspective of polished, skilled music and well-executed worship, the whole thing was just a hot mess. It would give church consultants a stroke. But let me tell you, I went to church that morning. I did. I mean, I really went to church. Because the worship was heartfelt and real and authentic and beautiful in its genuineness. It had none of the trappings and style that we expect, but those two women, they sang from their heart, and they spoke from their heart, and they prayed from their heart, and they shared from their heart. And despite the poverty in which they live and the challenges they face, and just making it through a day, and the lack of running water, and the social ills that are rampant on the reservation, they still knew their God to be a mighty God. And they still gave their everything to that mighty God. Nothing else mattered. I think that just might be our challenge this year. In the midst of all the stress this season induces, and the busyness and the distractions and the desperation for having everything to be just right, the most important thing we can do is to worship in the depth of our soul this Jesus who is mighty God. And here's why. When life feels out of control, we can fix our eyes on Him. To worship Him as mighty God is to remember that I am not the star of my own story, nor the center of the universe. God rules over it all. God's power and glory are in charge of everything. If my life is only about me, if the story of my existence is limited to what my dreams can dream and which of my desires are fulfilled and how hurt I am by the cruelties of life, then I ultimately have nothing to cling to. I need to remember again and again that I'm part of a greater story, a story of salvation, a story of divine love and mercy that began way before I arrived on the scene, is going to continue way after my little chapter is over. In this season, many of us may be facing things that feel as if they could squeeze the life from our soul, that constrict our hope and our joy. But Jesus, mighty God, has not lost track of you, and He wants to show Himself to you in all His majesty and power so that more of Him can fill your heart. He wants your eyes on His glory, but not for His sake, not because He's a narcissist who can only be happy when everyone is praising Him. He wants your eyes on His glory because when your eyes are on His glory, it means that they're no longer focused only on the happiness or the unhappiness that you feel or the hurt that you bear. I mean, there's nothing we need more when we are bound up in pain and doubled over by anxiety than to be given a chance to stop staring at it like a car wreck along the freeway. And stop fixating on the circumstances raging around us. And stop trying to make sense of things that make no sense. It's His glory, His mightiness, all contained in that child, on which we can train our eyes and, like Isaiah, strain forward to promises that he has made that maybe aren't yet fully realized, but know that they will be. Maybe not on our time schedule, but certainly on his, because he is mighty God. And that, in turn, changes our stance, our whole body language, from doubled over to outstretched, from cramped and hunched and closed off to open and uncoiled and receiving. And that, just even physically, allows us to breathe again, doesn't it? And to seek from him one more opportunity than we think we're able to make his name holy, to trust him for one more risk than we think we dare take, to cry out to him for one more word of forgiveness than we know we deserve, one more anchor of faith when our faith has been shredded into tatters by a gale force of struggle. And whether it is soon, whether it is tomorrow, or whether we yet have more darkness through which we must walk, to tie our hope to a mighty God who came in vulnerability and weakness. Because that is who I am. I am vulnerable. And I am weak. And I might make a good show of not being that, but I know I am. I'm little, but he is big, and he is mighty, and that's the way it should be, because that's all I need.